I'm Alan Grisby from the Strange and Unusual Podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to a very special edition of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we reach into our archives of interviews from L.I. Who, which we went to back in November. And this time, we're going to let you listen to us talk to Derek Sherwin, who was a script editor back during the classic times, during Pertwee's era, I believe. Is that correct, Mr. Hansen?
Yes, from the Troughton into Pertwee transition. He was actually pivotal to that transition. Jay is fired. So in case you're wondering where the Texan is, we got rid of him for obvious reasons. So, welcome to our house. Whose house? Our house. So as Haley alluded, back in November of last year, as we were attending the third LI Who, we got a chance to sit down with script editor and producer Derek Sherwin. He was the guest of honor for the weekend and had some brilliant insight to share with us about dealing with the show at a transitional period as they were nearing the end of Patrick Troughton's era. He was getting to a point where his just a fatigue factor in what he was pouring into the program was making it clear that they were going to have to find his successor. And Mr. Sherwin being as intrinsically involved with a lot of the script editing and principal direction of the storylines of the shows, as he explains it, it just dropped into a production producer slot just because there was no one else there to take it, essentially. But we'll let it go into his words on that. So we will roll tape. I can't pronounce the name of this. Hapag. We're somewhere in Long Island at the moment, and we are joined by this weekend's guest of honor, scriptwriter and producer for our classic, we like to call it our legendary period of Doctor Who, Mr. Derek Sherwin. Thank you for joining us today.
God, that makes me feel old.
Well,
I am.
Timeless.
No.
Timeless like the program.
I was born in 1936, which is exactly the year that the BBC was created. So the BBC and I are synonymous. I certainly grew up with it all my life.
Well, we wanted to speak with you this morning, specifically the fans who have just come around to find the program since its renaissance in 2005, and are just now drawing back to the previous decades to understand the foundations. They're discovering a lot of the work that you had done from 67 to 70, writing for the show, and giving us a lot of the core tenets that the program continues to use to this day, specifically.
Doctor Who,
the Doctor in particular, the casting of John Pertwee as that titular role, but we wanted to talk to you today about UNIT, actually.
Yes,
because just in our recently aired episodes, our Kate Stewart, daughter of Alistair, you know, Sir Alistair Lethbridge Stewart, has brought UNIT right back into the forefront again. And I was curious to chat with you about your thoughts when you created the premise of this military organization to assist the Doctor and be assisted by the Doctor, and the Brig character, whether you expected that to become as intrinsic to the show as it has been.
Yes, right. Okay. Well, UNIT was created for curious reasons. When I took over Doctor Who as a script editor, the Doctor himself was desperately overworked, and he was getting very, very, very tired. So it was down to me to provide some means by which I could take some of the weight of the show off his shoulders and put it onto other people. Now, this takes some considerable doing over time, because you can't just introduce a character and say, this is going to be the sidekick of Doctor Who. So I cast my mind back to the days when, in London, they created a similar unit. They didn't call it a unit. It's still working. It's called COBRA. It's a military unit which relates to clearing up all the unfortunate happenings. Like nowadays, ISS and all this stuff going on now. If it happens to affect London, COBRA are called in to deal with it. The same thing I thought I created the unit for. And at the same time, in the States, I think they were producing a new sci-fi series. What was it called? I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, it was an exploration of extraterrestrial activity.
And an organization responsible for
helping people. So that's why I created it, to take the weight off Doctor Who and also to provide some more interest for the viewers about things that were happening now, here in their country, possibly going to happen to them. So it was a reality in a way. So I created that, which gave us a good leeway to write about new characters. And so I created Lethbridge Stewart in The Web of Fear. And in fact, I created him in The Invasion. And since I was script editor, and it seemed to work in The Invasion, I was told by the producer then, Peter Bryant, put it back, let's introduce it in The Web of Fear. So I did, and that's where he was created.
Well, episode 41, the Web of Fear, is a story very near and dear to my heart. I've always been a tremendous fan of Nicholas Courtney's body of work within the Doctor Who scope and beyond.
Sure.
The many years that he assisted, even after, in Big Finish.
You went on for 3 years. Yeah.
Very much so. So when another element of the program that you were able to see introduced through your writing, which has become iconic, for the program to date, is our sonic screwdriver.
Yes.
But it was originally just a quick utilized tool.
Yeah, it was one of the things he used. In fact, I created the original sonic screwdriver in my workshop at home. My kids remember this distinctly. I said, Daddy, that's what you created. I don't know, it was this thing I made, which you went, and it worked. So other people, I think, say they created it, but they didn't. It's in my damn workshop. Out of a piece of plastic, a piece of wood, and a light.
Are you okay with what it has evolved into as far as its applications and its omnipresent uses?
Well, it's one of those use-it-fix-it-all type machines which you love to have in your back pocket, which Doctor Who had, and he had that kind of imagination which could use it. I haven't watched how it's been created too heavily since then. At a certain stage of Doctor Who, I left London and I went to live in Thailand for about 13 years. So I lost some of the things that were happening in the years. All those DVDs were sent out to me from London about the shows that were being done. I didn't view them all, of course. But the locals in Thailand, all the kids flocked around and said, can we watch Doctor Who? You can? And they were almost as much as fans as I was when I was working with it. Great, great kids. And they didn't really speak that much English.
Well, I guess it's as much of a visual experience
exactly,
as it is.
Yeah. This was magic for them. Magic.
It certainly is. With with the introduction of Mr. Pertwee into that role and, yeah. and your involvement in helping with that casting selection, mm-hmm. It was a very different dynamic when we knew that we were making the transition from Mr. Hartnell to Patrick coming
yes,
in because
yes.
the entire premise of the program had to evolve around mm-hmm. this change of cast.
Yeah.
You had a little bit more liberty when making the transition from our second Doctor to our third.
Not liberty, I took it. It was my job because the series was going down the pan, audience-wise. You know, it was down to almost like it is now, 4 million, I think, in the UK. And I had to build it up in order to get the money to make the shows, you know. That's the way the BBC worked in those days.
So what were the criteria you were utilizing to help make that casting decision? What were your stereotypes that you wanted to make sure you tapped into?
Well, I had to rely upon the original concept of Doctor Who for the audience. But it was for family. It wasn't like it is now, a sort of esoteric adult series, which seems to me to be anyway. It was for family, so I had to have a family-oriented character. So you had to be real, empathetic, and funny. You had to be funny, you know, because you can't be that realistic, that tragical all the time, you know. You have to have humour. And I had to put humour back into Doctor Who. Mind you, Pat Troughton was also very humorous. He's a good character, Pat, but he got so tired. That's his problem. That's why I had to take it out of that concentration on the way that Doctor Who acted in everything into something more expansive that people could understand in their lives. There was a series on BBC television before that called The Quatermass Experiment. Are you familiar with that?
By name.
Yeah. It was brilliant. It was only one or two shows, I think, and they also made films of it. But it's a great concept because it concentrated in London. It was something unusual that was happening, which was fascinating. It was pure science fiction. Around it, there were human characters, and that's what I wanted to make Doctor Who like. And so I thought John Pertwee would be great for that, and certainly taking some of the weight off of the character, which poor old Pat Troughton suffered from really badly.
Well, I think it was an extremely successful transition, and we owe a great deal not only to John's investment in the program, but what you've added to it as well. So, well, we thank you, Mr. Woodford, so much for joining us for this weekend. We hope you enjoy all the festivities and the chicanery that is going to be taking place around you.
I'm looking forward to it.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your time.
Bye.
So there you have it. I am continually impressed. I know we haven't really touched a lot of this audio in a number of months, but I was always really, really surprised at how sharp he is on top of all of the details related to everything he's done, 45 years ago? Just an amazing acuity for everything that he's poured into this program.
Yeah, and I went into this interview, I didn't know who Derek Sherwin was because I'm not as versed in the classic lore as others on the podcast might be, and it was interesting to see what he had brought to the show that we've come to love.
And that's exactly why we were leading with a lot of the questions that we wanted to know about things that we almost take for granted at this point, like the sonic screwdriver, it's his novelty, it's this thing that he had. Well, Mr. Sherwin was responsible for putting that together literally in his garage as his kids are wont to tell him. Or really just dealing with the transition point from Troughton into Pertwee and making the decisions. I was always really impressed with the way that he was describing it as, and maybe this is a matter of his perspective on things, the way of describing it as saving the show. Mm-hmm. Depending on which resource you read, you may not hear that the show was necessarily in such dire straits with the 4 million average viewers per episode and so forth. But if that was the time, if that perspective was at all accurate from the writer's room, then that idea of going back to the basics of rediscovering what the program's initial magic was a masterstroke.
Well, in making the show more sustainable for the actors by bringing in more of an ensemble cast, so you're not putting such a burden on your lead and you're not, you know, just wiping out that actor for
right.
however
Yeah, he mentioned that at a couple points as a matter of taking the weight off your primary actor. Initially, because of the fact that Patrick was getting physically and emotionally tired. You think about how much energy. Well, Haley, you'll come around to this when you're getting into that era, and you'll see the fact that he's in there at 105% all the time. Not only in terms of his presence within the scene and his ability to chew scenery, but just his energy levels was. You know, he had the companions running after him through everything, and they gave him, because of his natural ability to be more physical than William Hartnell could, and they wanted to capitalize on that. They had a more on the run, moving camera premise rather than kind of a stationary two camera layout sort of thing, and relying on scenes with your supporting actors to be all of the motion and action. Now you had a doctor who was on the run physically, and he rose to meet it. Not to mention the fact that he was an excellent physical actor, and his clowning ability, his ability to go for comedy and humor, had him pouring even more energy into it, because you're gunning for punchlines and going for moments and things. So, yeah, the toil it must have had on Patrick in the last handful of stories or so, and from the creators and writers' perspective, looking at it as saying, we need to either provide him with an out or find some way to lift this a little bit off of him. So bringing unit into the measures. And then when Mr. Trout decided finally that it was time to hand the reins over, being part of the selection process for what we now know is one of the most James Bondish action doctors that the classic era had. So, yeah, it was a fascinating conversation. In the 9 minutes we spoke with him, I gained a ton.
And this isn't something that came up during that conversation, but is the transition from Troughton to Pertwee when the show went from half hour to 1 hour?
No, it still maintained its shorter episodic nature. Yeah. But you get into the color transition.
Okay, so that's what it was, the color.
And it was just a matter of, I think, the way it was being marketed too. You started seeing a lot more merchandise involved with it. It was something where they really started to tie into it as something product oriented. So that gain, and there were substantial gains in terms of the viewership and in terms of the popularity, in terms of impression share, however you want to refer to it, that they could get into marketing it as product oriented. So, if you wondered why you didn't have as many Trout and Arrow lunchboxes, but you sure had a whole lot from the Pertwee era, well, there you go. Granted, maybe that overstayed. I wouldn't say overstayed. It's welcome. But maybe it stepped a little farther because they started getting into things like, well, let's try some gimmicks. The Whomobile, things of that sort. Maybe some could argue that they got a little too experimental at times. But the core tenets of what Mr. Sherwin and his contemporaries were putting into the program made an immense change with where the show continued and survived. So we'll get to a little bit of news. We got some.
Yeah.
A couple items wanted to make sure that we touched on, because it's been in just a single week since the last episode. We've got a kind of an interesting scatter of developments within the Hooniverse here. Do want to make sure, because we pay so much attention to everything that the ladies and gentlemen over at the Big Finish Studios put together, we want to make sure that we are pleased, calmed, sated, relaxed, reassured that they are going to be continuing to work with audio dramas from the Doctor Who and Torchwood universes for at least the next 9 years. We got the official press release from the head of audio publishing over at BBC Worldwide, Jan Patterson, who has announced that we are cleared through 2025 to give everything within their creative scope over to Jason Hay-Gallery and Nicholas Briggs over at Big Finish. So
Big Finish has planned out farther than Marvel Studios at this point.
By a handful of years. Just a handful.
Yeah.
But yeah, but then again, their development time, their concept to creation time, is a heck of a lot shorter.
Yeah.
So the volume of material is just insane. So yeah, we will definitely appreciate everything they want to put into our hands, because we always do. I haven't come across a single audio where I've sat back and said, no, I wish I had that 2 hours and change back. No, I always gain something from it. And that's from the Doctor Who main range and from all of the ancillary stories as well. So for those of you who want to get into The Prisoner, those of you who want to go back and get into Blake 7, any of those things, you are not going to go wrong. So in keeping with the audio scope, we did have an opportunity thanks to, I don't know how Digital Spy lands these interviews that they do, but Morgan Jeffrey over there at DS got a chance to sit and talk with David Tennant and Catherine Tate about their reactions to working on their latest Big Finish Return audios as Tenth and Donna, and everything that brought back to recent memory between the two of them. And granted, they've done a lot of work since outside of this, but it's like the proverbial putting on the comfortable gloves again. And so I almost don't want to say too much about this, because anything you could possibly do to describe how these two yutzes behave with one another could never do justice to just letting them riff on their own. So did you get a chance to watch this one, Haley?
Not yet, but I do wish like they had a podcast or something together.
Even really short. I would take just little 6-minute installments of just the two of them talking about what their drive into work that day was like. That's all. Anything. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of them is going to play the straight man, and the other is just going to be picking at the details. And
they're just so perfect together.
They are. It's their spouses must be so jealous of the of the chemistry that they have with one another. But do be aware that we are actually just about a week, the day we're recording here, we are a week away from the 10th Doctor Adventures being released as a box set with 3 new stories. So Monday, May 16th, you'll be able to get your hands on that. And it will be worth any penny or pence or dollar or pound you care to throw at it. I will personally guarantee that. And if you don't enjoy it, mail it to me, and I will return your money. And I will own them all 2 of them, mine and one other angry person. Because everyone else is going to keep a hold of it. I know this.
Somebody, there's always one guy that hates everything, but he still buys it.
Bow down to the Doctor of Slime, the Doctor of Putrescence. Sorry. So, all right. Another little piece here. I'm glad that the folks over at Fansided at the Doctor Who Watch decided to put this under their rumors column, because as we know, a good 42% of anything that comes out of John Barrowman's mouth these days falls immediately into the rumor bucket. Haley, do you want to describe exactly what it is that Mr. Barrowman is alluding to right now?
Well, I didn't get a chance to watch this.
Okay.
But
it's brief. It's only the fact that he has been spending a little bit of time in Cardiff, and he decided not to describe why. Now, granted, he could have been there because of some work that he was doing with his sister Carol on any of their book tours. It could have been something because he was doing more post-production or cleanup work or trailer work or promo work on any of the audio that he's been recently doing with Big Finish. It could have been for anything. It could have been because he was adding a video clip that was going to be incorporated somehow into the Doctor Who experience. Could have been anything. But knowing John, and knowing the way that he likes to goad his fan base, and the way that his fan base reacts insanely to everything that he says, the theory now is that he may be finally fulfilling one of these statements that had been floated by Moffat years ago that said, well, you know, you get to a certain point where you never want to say never about including characters like Jack Harkness again, but it would have to be something extra special. Well, there's a Christmas episode coming up. That is the only new content that we're going to be getting from the Doctor Who camp in 2016, period. So isn't that special enough? Because the Doctor technically doesn't have a companion right now.
Yeah.
Technically, because we don't know where Bill comes into the mix here. So
maybe
no. So tip your proverbial scales. Go ahead.
Has Moffat played with Captain Jack since he became the showrunner?
I think there was a name check.
Okay,
but
because he introduced the character, mm-hmm. and then he didn't get to play with his toy.
No. But then you got to wonder. I mean, and think about this. If it's a single Christmas episode, I guess I am playing devil's advocate, but I'm looking at the ways that it could not work. And I see it as if Jack is a character that needs an established reason to be there. After everything that's happened, you know, and after everything that Capaldi's Doctor has been through over the last series and a half, that now you decide to bring Jack in when he's at a particularly low point. I mean, I don't even know how they're going to cast the tone of this Christmas episode in light of everything that's happened and the way the previous season just wrapped up. He's... formulaically, that this is now where the Doctor goes into a dark place. You know, you think about Smith on his own when he first met Clara. You know,
the snowman.
So this is that weird spot. So if it's Jack, he's in any way involved with this.
It seems like bringing Jack in comes with a lot of baggage to throw him just into a Christmas episode.
Jack is a lot of baggage.
Yeah. Especially with how, I mean, we've talked about it before, but the way Torchwood ended, something has to happen to resolve some of that character stuff before you can just throw him into an adventure.
Absolutely. There's the whole where were you discussion. There's the what's with the new face discussion. Well, because Jack never met Eleven.
Frobisher.
Never met Eleven.
Oh, no, he met Eleven either. Yeah,
so,
he met Frobisher.
Yeah. Oh, but yeah, the Frobisher dynamic would be insane because that's relatively, I mean, time relativity, that's within, you know, the last handful of years as far as Jack's memory, and Jack's not one to forget much. So yeah, that's, you'd end up dominating more than half the Christmas episode, just the two of them hashing out all their issues with one another.
An airing of grievances.
the traditional... Okay, well, maybe it does make sense for the holidays.
Just bring back the Paternoster Gang.
Something.
Bring back the Paternoster Gang. You let Captain Jack hit on, you know, the lizard and the other one and the potato. It'll be fine.
Oh, he'll hit on the potato. I feel really bad for Dan Starkey when he has to to hold himself back from John Barrowman coming at him full force with all this charm.
You know he can't run in that thing.
No, he can barely breathe. Wow. All right. And our last little news item for tonight is another. I'm gonna keep this with one foot in the rumor bucket because this is one thing that we've discussed a lot on GPR, and we've actually had an opportunity to talk to a couple of writers about this. I know when we were at Galley year before last, and we had all of our writers and script editors up on a panel. We had, who was up there at the time? I think Paul Cornell was up there. Jamie Matheson was up on the panel at the time. Who else was up there? I can't even recall.
No, it wouldn't have been.
I got a chance to quickly ask them about the dynamic of collaboration between writers over the course of a series and whether or not they actually get much of an opportunity to communicate with one another as far as steering corrections, as far as status checks as they're going through their script development, and Moffat's involvement as your executive producer and head writer to oversee where things are evolving, to look for a common thread. And they made it very clear, in fact, I think it was Jamie Matheson who pointed out that it's very unlike a U.S. script writing dynamic because it doesn't have a writer's room. You're working in isolation. You submit, you get a rewrite and handful of notes and you go through
It's very much this episode is your episode and you write this episode.
Right. And if there is any sort of a consistency or a tie line between episodes, it's because that's some of the skeletal notes you were given at the outset, or maybe something that you're handed in a first or second edit that says, make sure you hit upon.
Yeah. I mean, they're still getting notes from somebody, but it's not a collaborative process the way it is in a lot of American shows.
So I guess one of the things that has been discussed under Chris Chibnall when we start getting into the 2018 development process is that they may be taking on the idea of having multiple writers on pivotal or crux episodes that require major changes in storyline or arc development. So I guess BBC has been in conversation with the Writers Guild of Great Britain and looking at potentially new approaches to the way that scripts get developed within this particular dramatic production, but it may have repercussions going out across a lot of other releases from BBC Drama. So,
and according to this article, the union has said there's no issues with it if that's the way they want to proceed.
Yeah, I mean, if it produces the best product for what it is that they're attempting to attempting to put forth, I know when, and I'm so glad they mentioned this within the article. Paul Cornell, whom we absolutely adore, and we've had a chance to speak with him a number of times. Actually,
some of us have been on a panel with him.
You have shared a panel with him, and he was so excited when he found out how many comic book podcasts you write. He literally bounced in his chair. when he was writing Human Nature and Family of Blood for Tennant, he actually requested that the show be written by a group of writers. You know, the idea of having... If you're dealing with a concept, especially with something on a program that is so continuity focused, and has built itself 5 decades of complexity, and anything that you introduce, I mean, I'd love to be able to. I know we've chatted very briefly with Sarah Dollard, and she doesn't want to come on the podcast because she doesn't do podcasts. She gets anxiety attacks and such. But we're going to do a Q&A with her shortly, and we'll sort of. Describe, we'll transcribe her results and things and put it in the notes.
We'll do a dramatic reenactment.
That's it. So Haley, put on your blonde wig. So, but one of the things that that she had noted is that in putting these things together and having just a couple of bounces off it, there was all of this tension in handing over a completely finished work that she had done encapsulated. She locked herself away. She put this labor of love together. She handed it over and just waited for the hatchets to go at it. I have to wonder if something like this, where every once in a while, especially for freshman writers or even sophomore writers, to be able to lean over every once in a while and say, "All right, I want to take a chance on something. I know I'm not a veteran as far as these descriptors go, but I have this passionate idea that I really think could work, but I don't want to waste, you know, 4, 6, 8 weeks of writing time putting something together that's going to get thrown back at me and say, it's a complete continuity break. What are you doing?" So to have a room full of people that you could at least start to float these things off of, I would think that's got some merit.
Well, I mean, and what if somebody has something that could have been I'll just take the opposite side as you took. That could have been a great idea, leans over, and the guy next to him is like, "Oh, no, that's a terrible idea. Don't waste your time on that." But it was actually a great idea. What I think the writer's room does is it smooths out the peaks and the valleys.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get, you know, the big flaming turds as much because you've got a room full of people like, "Dude, what are you doing?" But I think you also limit your chance at getting that shining beacon of starry light of an episode as well.
Yeah, no, that's, well, I don't know. You would hope that the individuals that you have in that room have enough of an open mind to know that if somebody comes in with a disruptive genius moment. That even if it's something you realize is going to ruffle a lot of feathers, it has its merits for its ingenuity. Mm-hmm. I guess it really depends on who you end up surrounded with. And a lot of that ends up falling back on, Chris Chibnall and company to say, all right, if we're going to do this writer's room thing, and granted, they didn't say that this is going to be the whole new paradigm shift. This is going to be for...
They said they were going to try it for some special episodes.
Right. Yeah. So I guess this isn't completely out of the question. This isn't something that has not been done in smaller scale in other BBC productions. I want to say it was Life on Mars. I know it wasn't Being Human. I want to say it was Life on Mars was one where there was a little bit more writer collaborative effort. There were at least two writers listed at times, even three or more that were involved in, because that was something where continuity was critical because of the fact that it was a short-lived series and you had to hit on a lot of key points. I want to hear more from this because I think we've all kind of chimed in on this over the past 6 months or so, that the writing process, the creative process, is such a fascinating component of this show that we continue to pick apart like this. And we talk about the showrunner all the time. We talk about the actors' performances at all times and how much Melissa Gomez and everything. Oh, great. And where you stand on all these changes that happen within the series. But the stories that they're putting forth are the meat and potatoes of this entire thing. So the individuals who are coming up with these ideas, whether it's someone who says, you know what, I'm going to go back and I'm going to grab something from 30 years ago. I'm going to spin it. I'm going to hand it back to you with a new twist and you're going to love it. Or somebody that says, I've got something that no one has thought of for the show for 52 years. I have something new. Check it out. And these are the people that we rely on to keep us so engaged. So I'm fascinated to see where this develops.
Yeah, just a little bit of nuts and bolts stuff they put in at the end of the article. It talks about how in the U.S., the writer's room works because you've already got most of your writers living in either L.A. or New York. And that's not necessarily the case in the UK. A lot of people are, working out of their apartment, which might be 50 miles from London.
Right.
So it might not be as practical there to have a writer's room unless they can figure out a way to get these people together.
Getting into central London from 50 miles out is a Herculean task.
Yeah, they might have to change how much they're paying their writers.
Just for gas compensation.
What? I can't sit at home and eat hot pockets all day? What?
Hot pockets. Yeah. So I'm definitely going to stay keyed into this particular story. And credit to Ben Dowell from over at Radio Times for sharing this article. This is interesting stuff. Fascinating stuff as far as I'm concerned. But if you've got ways that you want to chime in on this, if you have things that you want to share with regards to your opinions on where Big Finish is headed, where the writer's room concept is headed, or anything in between. Or if you have just some reactions to some of the things that Mr. Sherwin was able to share with us with this interview, please make sure that you do so. Head over to iTunes, head to Facebook, head to Twitter. Head to Twitter. Go ahead. It doesn't really interrupt my day much. I'll talk back with you. I'll ignore work all day long. That's... I don't care.
I'll read the tweets. I probably won't say anything.
So we will make sure that we share all the ways that you can get in touch with us at the end of the cast. But in this completely unnumbered and non-sequential bonus episode of Gallifrey Public Radio, this is Kira saying, you know what? Texas could secede from the Union right now, and I think the podcast would do just fine.
Yeah. And this is Haley saying that, Jay, do your homework.
Slacker. He's probably on page 2 of the 10 pages that he's got to get completed for this grad final right now. But so be it. I'll send him a supportive memes.
All right, I'll send him a bunch of puppy videos on YouTube.
Oh, the puppy videos. Sure, sure. Yep. All right. Well, Hecker's going to bork. So, all right. Good night, kids.
Night.
Adelzy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.